This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
As world leaders and investors board their carbon-spewing jets for Davos, they're all finally saying the same thing. The climate crisis is bad for business. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Oakland, California, I'm Molly Wood in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, January 20th, and it's good to be with you on this Martin Luther King Jr. Day. We begin today with the state of the planet, which is also the corporate zeitgeist of the moment. The fancy executive shindig in the Swiss Alps known as Davos is underway today. And for the first time, a survey of participants in the World Economic Forum, Davos's official title, ranked climate change as their top set of business concerns. Also last week, Larry Fink, CEO of BlackRock, the world's largest asset manager, told business leaders that the company would prioritize more sustainable investing. And then on Thursday, Microsoft announced plans to become carbon negative by the year 2030 and is investing $1 billion in carbon removing technologies. Microsoft said it hopes that by 2050, it could remove as much carbon as it has generated in its entire 44-year history. Lucas Jopa is the chief environmental officer at Microsoft, and he's here to talk about this plan. Lucas, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me on, Molly.
You've pledged to invest $1 billion and also to sort of pivot efforts in the direction of removing carbon and technologies that can create resilience and sustainability, but also literally remove carbon. And I wonder what some of those technologies are. Have you identified investment opportunities already?
Well, I think first and foremost, evolution has already provided some of the most powerful removal technologies of all through processes like photosynthesis. So some of the work that we'll be investing in will be in what's called nature-based solutions through afforestation, reforestation, soil carbon sequestration. But also we'll be looking at negative emission technologies like direct air capture, carbon capture and storage, bioenergy. And what we're really motivated to do is to ensure that the capital that we put out is as additional as possible.
Is it a venture fund? Like, are you expecting to get financial returns in addition to technologies that you can use?
We don't expect to. That is not a requirement of the fund. We would never turn that down, I'm sure. But we also don't expect to lose money.
How do we, you know, so many companies are announcing sustainability initiatives and carbon neutral initiatives, and it's getting hard to parse who is doing what, you know? Like, how do we know, either in the business community or as consumers, that this isn't greenwashing?
Well, I think it requires diligence on the side of stakeholders to actually spend a little time, you know, understanding what companies are actually doing. I think it also requires a lot of work on the side of corporations to be as transparent and as literal as possible. So there's a reason that we're using the term carbon negative, because what we are saying is we are going to go below net zero on our overall carbon emissions. And we can provide an accounting for that. We can provide transparency into the portfolio of payments that we're making to remove carbon. I think the best we can do is just to be clear-eyed and cold-hearted accountants about this and hold up our balance sheets of carbon to be inspected.
Let's also talk about incentives. Is this becoming a move like this on some level for every business? You know, we've seen institutional investor BlackRock say it's going to require its companies to have sustainability plans. JetBlue is going carbon neutral and citing flight shaming as part of the reason. I wonder if some of this is becoming a business imperative, whether it's to get ahead of regulation or even public sentiment.
Oh, absolutely. I think it's surprising that businesses can operate today without meaningful and credible sustainability plans. And I do not think there's a significant future where businesses will be able to succeed without having plans and being able to show meaningful progress. I think the BlackRock letter was a nice example, but that's just one of an incredible number of market signals that are being sent from both consumers, customers, regulators, employees, and more.
In the blog post announcing this, you said climate needs to become the world's next moonshot. The tech industry, that's a phrase that has bounced around, the tech industry, but also it's an industry that has promised to solve big problems. Should the rest of the industry be following this example?
I think the rest of the industry needs to do what everybody needs to do, which is to look at climate and sustainability as what it is, which is the largest issue, the largest, most complex challenge that our species has ever faced. If you're a technology company, I believe that you should be bringing technology solutions to the market. That does not mean that technology solutions are the silver bullet. It just means that whatever you as an organization are good at, that's what you need to be bringing. And the urgency has never been greater.
And then how about hiring? In your blog post, you cite not just consumer demand, but also employee demand. Is this also a way, does this have the added benefit of helping you attract and retain talent for whom this is a big concern?
Most definitely. I mean, when you look at any poll and the demographic that will be entering the workforce, you know, today and the next 5 to 10 years moving forward, this is the number one issue they care about. And if you're a technology company like Microsoft is, then you're probably motivated by solving big problems with scalable solutions. And if that's your MO, then you've got to have climate and sustainability squarely within your focus. And your employees, the more that you do that, the more and the better the employee base that you're going to be able to bring in. It's just going to be an expectation, and rightfully so.
And then finally, just from a business perspective, you know, we've seen Microsoft employees already sort of ask the company not to do business to help, let's say, improve the efficiency of oil and gas companies. Microsoft has a 7-year deal with Chevron. Is there some possibility that, you know, the aggressiveness in this arena will make for some awkward dance partners?
I don't know about awkward. I think that these are conversations that need to be had, and we're committing as part of our overall announcement to include conversations about and partnerships on sustainability and carbon reduction removal with all of our enterprise customers and major suppliers, you know, market sector independent. I think that if you take a scientific or a scientist's view of the problem, you leave a lot of the passion and politics out of it, and you just focus on the job that needs to get done. And if you believe, like we do, that this problem is one that's going to require solutions from everybody, from every organization, then it would seem strange to be turning your back on any particular sector or customer. That said, you know, of course, these conversations aren't always easy, aren't always straightforward, but I think that as long as you just focus on the problem at hand that needs to be solved, you know, we've always appreciated a partnership model at Microsoft, and I don't see that changing going forward with any of our existing or future customers.
Lucas Jopa is Chief Environmental Officer at Microsoft. Thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you, Molly.
You can hear more about how technology can help us deal with climate change in our series, How We Survive. That's online at marketplace.org. U.S. markets were closed today. We will check in with the markets abroad, and we'll have all those details when we do the numbers. Now a little more on what's happening at Davos this week. One of the key themes will be what the organizers are calling stakeholder capitalism. That is, for businesses to steer their profits not just to stockholders, but to other so-called stakeholders, like workers, customers, and the environment. It is a long-term focus that proponents say is also good for business. Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
This year's Davos includes a manifesto stating that a company should serve all of its stakeholders, starting with paying workers more. Judy Samuelson at the Aspen Institute's Business and Society Program says things are changing. She notes that Delta Airlines just gave every worker 2 months of extra pay to share its profits.
I think we're seeing some great examples of companies that have strong profit-sharing plans. So whether it's in Davos or anywhere else, we really hope that we're getting to a different kind of conversation about who's contributing and are the rewards being really shared.
Still, she says 90% of corporate profits now go to stockholders. Now, serving stockholders and quarterly earnings has been a dominant corporate model since the 80s. But Bill George, the former CEO of Medtronic, says that's rewarded Wall Street at the expense of Main Street.
This shareholder-only approach has contributed significantly to the income inequality we have in this country. We shifted from the manufacturing sector to the finance sector, and this has hollowed out communities, as you know.
To him, a big key is executive compensation, paying them for long-term results instead of just today's stock price. Now, he and others argue that it's in company self-interest to think differently. Paying workers more can retain them, and pouring profits into research can spur innovation. Now, this argument faces a tough crowd in the U.S., says Peter Capelli at the Wharton Business School. But he says, not elsewhere.
Once you leave the U.S., the belief that shareholder value is the prime goal fades a lot. So when U.S. executives go to Davos and mingle with everybody else, you know, it sort of changes the social norms.
He says one sign of change is the American CEO group called the Business Roundtable last fall called for a more balanced type of capitalism. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
One last bit of news coming out of Davos, even though no, Marketplace is not actually there. But the International Monetary Fund today released its updated World Economic Outlook for 2020. And the IMF says prospects for the global economy have deteriorated a bit since its last forecast, which was issued back in October. Growth is now expected to come in at 3.3% for the year, compared to 2.9% last year. That, by the way, was the slowest rate since the financial crisis. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has got more on that.
Last year, the world economy was dragged down by U.S. tariff threats and the escalating trade war with China, by a global manufacturing slump and rising recession risks. By early this year, central banks had cut interest rates to pump up spending and investment, and the U.S. and China had signed a Phase One trade deal. But Jacob Kierkegaard at the Peterson Institute warns that getting to a Phase Two deal with China will be much harder, and the Trump administration could still escalate trade conflicts with our partners in Europe and the Middle East.
This isn't exactly an optimistic outlook. We barely get above 3%. For the global economy, which used to be recessionary territory 10 years ago.
The IMF identifies several risks going forward: geopolitical tensions between the U.S. and Iran that could disrupt oil supplies, and social unrest in places like India, Lebanon, and Chile.
In a turbulent world, the U.S. used to be a rock of stability, but it has now become a source of instability.
Economist Ishwar Prasad at Cornell says the Trump administration has sowed uncertainty by scrapping trade treaties and attacking the World Trade Organization. Ironically, he says that hasn't harmed U.S. financial markets.
There is the paradox, of course, that if there is trouble anywhere in the world, including in the U.S., people bring their money to the U.S. for safekeeping.
The IMF predicts the U.S. economy will continue to slow moderately to 2% growth this year. Ryan Dietrich at LPL Financial points out 2020 is an election year, and when an incumbent runs for a second term, markets tend to rise.
You have to go all the way back to 1940 with FDR, the last time the S&P 500 was actually negative. It's about getting reelected, putting policies in place to get the stock market higher and get the economy higher.
There's also the impeachment wild card, but Dietrich doesn't think that'll rile markets or the economy very much. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Coming up,
I'm really glad overall that we're exposing toxic leadership. But I also want to make sure that these practices and this questioning is being applied to all companies.
Do female CEOs get more scrutiny than the men do? But first, let's do the numbers. Here in the U.S., markets are closed for the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. Futures were mostly flat, despite news that France's Emmanuel Macron and President Trump agreed to hold off on tariffs in their battle over digital taxes, at least for this year. In Europe, Britain's FTSE and France's CAC 40 were both down 0.3%. Germany's DAX rose 0.1%. And in Asia, the Nikkei also gained 0.1%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns, meaning when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal, rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. Let's continue our global economic theme here with a story about the housing crunch in Ireland. That country has seen huge economic improvement since the financial crisis 10 years ago. But now, much like in the U.S., Ireland has a housing crisis. Many people simply cannot afford to buy homes. Now, there is a system called social housing there. Citizens can get on a list for cheaper state-subsidized housing. But these days, there are thousands of people on those lists, and the odds are not good. The BBC's Helen Devlin takes us to Dublin to investigate.
Anita is angry. The 33-year-old mother of three has been living in a homeless hostel in North Dublin since she was evicted from her rental home. Unable to afford to rent another property, she turned to a housing charity for support. And while her family now have a roof over their heads, the continuing uncertainty is having a devastating impact.
My eldest child has recently been suffering with mental health issues. She's having thoughts of self-harm and all, which is horrific.
Anita's family are far from alone. One woman who knows all about the crisis is Dublin County Councillor Carly Bailey.
We have an office downstairs. It's a homeless office and it's always full. Standing room only most mornings.
Carly herself was made homeless twice in the last few years and now spends her time dealing with the daily realities of the housing crisis.
The situation really is, it's awful. It's genuinely so, so bad. In our particular area, South Dublin County Council, for example, there's over 6,500 people on a social housing list. For the vast majority of those, they're going to be on that list for 12 years or more. And when all we hear constantly as an excuse from this, that these things take time, they've had years and we're still not seeing any movement.
Much of the anger is being directed towards the government and its policies, but also towards companies and institutional landlords who bought or built thousands of units in the last few years, paying little or nothing in Irish tax, while openly speaking about charging the highest possible rent. It's not the only factor at play. Dr. Lorcan Sir is a lecturer in housing studies at Technological University Dublin.
Most of the solutions are relying on the private sector to provide a solution for the state. And a good example of that is people who turn up to their local authority asking to be housed. And there are no council or local authority houses for them to go into, so they are increasingly being put into the private rental sector.
While there's no one cause to the housing crisis, the man charged with solving it is the Minister for Housing, Owen Murphy. I've come to government buildings in the centre of Dublin to meet him.
The root of all of this thing, if we want to talk about people in emergency accommodation, if we want to talk about people paying too high a rent, if we're not supplying enough homes, we're not going to be able to address those other measures. And what we see now today, in line with our targets, will bring about approximately about 25,000 new homes to live in. But there continues to be pressures around things like rent because we continue to still have an undersupply of housing. But added to that, we had new demand coming into the country. And that's increased the pressures that we've been facing.
Despite years of strong economic growth, it appears there's no quick solution to Ireland's housing crisis. But for the thousands of Irish families still waiting for a place to live, a resolution can't come soon enough. In Dublin, Ireland, I'm the BBC's Helen Devlin for Marketplace.
Late last year, Steph Corey, the co-founder and CEO of trendy luggage company Away, resigned after a negative story and a lot of online backlash about the company's toxic workplace. Those stories came after similar reports on other startups like Thinks, Third Love, and Clio, which are all female-founded and led. And while toxic behaviors in the workplace are never acceptable, where is the criticism for controversial companies with men at the top? That is the question asked by Sarah Moskopf, CEO and co-founder of childcare marketplace Winnie. She recently wrote about this for TechCrunch. Sarah, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Sarah, what inspired you to write about this topic, what you describe as a society that's unfair in its criticism of women CEOs?
Yeah, so a couple things. I mean, first, I'm really glad overall that we're exposing toxic leadership. I also want to make sure that these practices and this questioning is being applied to all companies. There was a recent report that came out that 2.8% of venture capital goes to female-founded and led companies, and that's actually an all-time high this year. So, in other words, you'd expect that 2.8% of startups exposed for having these toxic work environments would be female-founded and female-led, and that isn't true if you look at kind of a lot of the companies in the news. So we have to do a much better job of exposing bad male-led workplaces, and especially before they get to be, you know, the size of Uber. You shouldn't be able to get away with this kind of behavior for a decade and then walk away with billions of dollars.
Right. Let's talk about startup culture specifically for a minute, because it does feel like, you know, I had a female founder say to me, we're all texting these articles to each other, you know, about Thinks and Clio and Third Love and Away. And we're thinking that at least some of the things in here could easily apply to me, right? Like this woman said, I'm just waiting for my expose to come out, because on some level, at least the work part the sort of the demanding part, the long hours, that's just sort of considered table stakes for working at a startup, right?
Yeah, it is. And I'm glad, you know, we're starting to question whether that is table stakes. We have for a long time at Winnie said that actually you can get more out of people by having them work fewer hours and treating them like adults. And if we respect them, they respect the company. So I'm really glad that that is starting to be something we call into question. I did kind of chuckle to myself. One of the things, you know, mentioned in the latest piece was 3 a.m. Slack messages. And I'm commonly on Slack at 3 a.m. while breastfeeding my daughter. But I do make sure to kind of explicitly state, like, no one should feel the need to respond to this until they're working. But that is part of having flexibility, is that, you know, when I can get my work done is sometimes at 3 a.m. in the middle of the night when I'm breastfeeding. And I believe that that should be something we accept and welcome, as long as we're just really clear and over-communicate that we don't expect that anyone respond if those aren't their working hours.
Do you think that the environment that you're describing, this idea that, you know, every female founder who already had to work so hard to get where she is, to get the funding at all, to probably get less funding than her male counterparts, also faces what you call the inevitable takedown of the female CEO. Do you think that that just keeps more women from wanting to found companies in the first place?
I do think it definitely does hurt women when they see this kind of news in the press. It doesn't mean we shouldn't expose these bad companies, but we should also share the stories of women who are mothers who are building companies at the same time as they're building their families and have great work-life balance. And so part of me writing the piece is I feel like I owe it to other female founders and other women who are contemplating starting companies to show them that it is possible and that there's a model for this that doesn't have to look like the male founders that are these dictators that are creating these toxic environments. We can do things differently and we should do things differently.
Sarah Moskoff is CEO and co-founder of Winnie. Sarah, thanks so much for the time.
Thank you so much.
Plot twist, since Sarah and I spoke, Away's co-founder Steph Curry has been reinstated as the co-CEO after she and the board realized maybe ousting her was an overreaction. I guess we'll see how things change. This final note on the way out today, as we talk about climate change, economic justice, and remember Martin Luther King Jr. and his fight for racial justice, we should note that all three of those things are linked. Research published last week showed that in 108 cities across America, the hottest neighborhoods, sometimes by as much as 13 degrees, are also the neighborhoods that are mostly poor and majority black and brown, and that this is a direct result of racist housing practices known as redlining in the 1930s and beyond. That research was conducted by Portland State University, the Science Museum of Virginia, and Virginia Commonwealth University. All right, we have got to go. Markets were closed today in observance of Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Andy Corbin, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Bennett Purser. Eliza Mills is our special projects producer, and I am Molly Wood. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.